Well, hello and welcome to the iFormRx podcast, where we explore the evidence that informs ambulatory care pharmacy practice. This is Stuart Haynes, and I'm your host of the iFormRx podcast. In today's episode, we'll be examining the risks and benefits of using dual antithrombotic therapy in patients with ischemic heart disease and atrial fibrillation. For many years, I managed an anticoagulation clinic, and it was pretty common to see patients taking both warfarin and low-dose aspirin. At the time, the data wasn't yet clear as to what to do when patients had an indication for antiplatelet therapy as well as an indication for warfarin therapy. With the increasing use of DOACs, I think the issue has reemerged. What should we do if a patient has ischemic heart disease, perhaps has had a stent placement, but who develops atrial fibrillation and would benefit from a direct oral anticoagulant for stroke prevention? Well, that's precisely the question that the recently published AFIRE study attempted to answer. And here to explore the results and application of the AFIRE study are Dr. Alina Kukin and Dr. Zachary Knoll from the University of Maryland. Dr. Kukin is a PGY2 cardiology pharmacy practice resident, and Dr. Knoll is a clinical pharmacy specialist at the University of Maryland Medical Center, as well as on faculty at the School of Pharmacy just across the street in Baltimore. Together, they wrote a commentary for iFormRx entitled Up in Flames, Aspirin in Patients with Stable Ischemic Heart Disease Receiving Anticoagulation for AFib. So, Alina, Zach, I'm so grateful you could join me today on the iFormRx podcast. So, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Stuart, truly a privilege to be on the podcast with you. And we're both looking forward to the discussion today.
So, before we get started, I'd like to start with a patient case. I want you to imagine you're seeing TL, a 71-year-old Caucasian male, in the cardiology clinic today. This morning, the patient was discovered to be in atrial fibrillation, and the cardiologist referred the patient to you to initiate anticoagulation therapy. Cardioversion is not being considered, so the patient has a history of high blood pressure, dyslipidemia, and he's obese. About a year ago, the patient was hospitalized with unstable angina and had two bare metal stents placed. The patient states he feels fine, quote unquote, and had no idea that he had an abnormal heart rhythm. He's currently taking clopidogrel 75 milligrams daily, carvedilol 25 milligrams twice daily, valsartan hydrochlorothiazide combination product daily, simvastatin daily, and he currently weighs 232 pounds with a BMI of 37.4. His blood pressure was 144 over 82, and he had a Chem7 and fasting lipid panel drawn this morning. His blood glucose was 103, serum creatinine of 1.1, LDL cholesterol of 84, HDL of 31, and his triglycerides was 213 milligrams per deciliter. And although the patient has Medicare Part D to cover the cost of his medications, he states that he has limited means and even the co-pays for his medications and visits are kind of tough to pay. So before we get into the details about the AFIRE study, can you tell us a little bit about some of the things going through your mind in this case? What additional information might you want to collect and assess during this encounter? And are there any additional treatment options you'd consider at this point?
So a few things that are kind of going through my mind right now hearing this case are about the timing of the stent placement. So obviously that's really important. In this patient's case, the stent was placed about a year ago. But of course, when we're a little bit further out from the time of stent placement, there's less of a thrombogenic risk. So it's always something to consider. The other thing is, was this patient's first ACS event, or has he had recurrent events? Because of course, if he's had recurrent events, he's at a higher risk. And some other risk factors that I'm thinking about are, is the patient diabetic? Is the patient a smoker? Our patient doesn't seem to have these in this case, but if he were, this would definitely increase the risk of future cardiovascular events. Another thing that's always on my mind with these patients is what type of stent was placed. So in this case, it was a bare metal stent. And so the recommendation for ACS is really going to be 12 months of dual antiplatelet therapy, regardless of the stent type. but still something to consider since we know bare metal stents are less thrombogenic than drug-eluting stents, for example. The CHA2DS2-VASc score in this patient is, of course, going to be important to calculate. So from what I heard, it sounds like it's 3, given the hypertension, age, and the coronary artery disease. And so in this case, I would say anticoagulation would be recommended for this patient based on the new AFib guidelines by AHA/ACC. Given that in men who have a score of 2 or more, or in women who have a score of 3 or more, anticoagulation is going to be highly recommended. And so some potential treatment options that I'm thinking about is that we could potentially change the clopidogrel to aspirin and start anticoagulation. We could maybe start anticoagulation in addition to clopidogrel, or perhaps we could stop antiplatelet therapy and start anticoagulation. So we have a bunch of options.
So some additional things that come to mind, particularly as we start to consider anticoagulation options, are the patient's renal function and concomitant medications. Neither of these factors seem like they'll significantly alter treatment for this patient, but something that might is cost. And so one of the things we need to think about is cost of not only medication, but also monitoring, right? So if we're thinking about warfarin, we obviously need to take into account cost to get the INR drawn, cost to travel to the clinic to get the INRs drawn, et cetera. And then, of course, DOACs being non-generic or brand-only products, we have to consider the cost of those. Maybe there's an advantage if we're able to stop a medication and save a copay there, that gives us more room for another medication and the costs associated with it.
So, Alina, let's talk about the study you critically reviewed in your iFormerX commentary. The study was entitled Antithrombotic Therapy in Atrial Fibrillation with Stable Coronary Disease, and it was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in September of 2019. We provide a link to the paper on the iFormerX website, but for those in our audience who haven't read the paper, can you give us a brief summary of the study design and its major findings?
Yeah, of course. So in short, the AFIRE trial was a multi-center randomized open-label parallel group study in Japanese patients that compared rivaroxaban monotherapy to rivaroxaban and antiplatelet combination therapy in patients with atrial fibrillation and stable coronary artery disease, which the authors in this study defined as at least 1 year out from PCI or CABG or with angiographically confirmed CAD that did not require revascularization. So the rivaroxaban was dosed at 15 milligrams daily, and the dose was reduced for patients who had a creatinine clearance between 15 and 49 mL per minute to a dose of 10 milligrams daily. The primary endpoint was a composite of stroke, systemic embolism, MI, unstable angina requiring revascularization, or death from any cause. And the primary safety endpoint was major bleeding as defined by the International Society of Thrombosis and Hemostasis. In terms of the antiplatelet agents that were administered in this study, in the combination arm, 70% of patients received aspirin, with the remainder of patients receiving almost exclusively clopidogrel. In terms of patient demographics, approximately 40% had diabetes, 70% had prior PCI, and 10% had prior CABG. So what the authors found was that monotherapy was non-inferior for the primary efficacy endpoint and superior for the primary safety endpoint. After a median treatment period of 23 months, the trial was actually terminated early because of higher death in the combination group.
So Zach, no study is without limitations. What do you believe to be some of the key strengths and weaknesses of the study? Do you have concerns about potential sources of bias and confounders? And what about the generalizability of this study? It was conducted in Japanese patients. And finally, would the results, do you think, be applicable to other DOACs, such as apixaban, which is frequently used?
Yeah, I think the single most important distinction that should be made up front with this study is the patient population that it was studied in. Japanese patients are known to have upwards of 40% higher concentrations of rivaroxaban compared to other populations. So for that reason, they use 15 milligrams instead of the traditional U.S. FDA-approved dose of 20 milligrams. And so I really can't emphasize enough the significance of recognizing that, because when it comes time to applying it in Western cultures, it's really important to use the full 20 milligram dose. Some strengths of the trial, though, that are noteworthy are obviously the prospective nature of the trial. The patients included had a moderate stroke risk. The median CHADS VASC was around 4. And the majority of patients did have a history of PCI. On the other hand, this was an open label trial, so the investigators and the patients knew what they were receiving. And the choice of the antiplatelet was left up to the discretion of the treating physician. Other limitations, only 35% of the patients had a prior MI, which I think many would argue is relatively low. And few patients had a history of stroke or peripheral vascular disease. Adherence also wasn't recorded in the trial. And lastly, I think it's noteworthy that the trial was stopped early. This could potentially alter the magnitude of the benefit that was seen. It could possibly be overestimated since the trial was terminated early.
And I'll just add that it's definitely important to keep in mind a few other characteristics about the patient population that was included in the FIRE trial. So patients were excluded if they had a history of stent thrombosis. Also, if they had poorly controlled hypertension, which the authors in this trial defined as a systolic blood pressure greater than 160 millimeters of mercury. It's also unclear how other genetic, environmental, and even lifestyle factors, including diet, of the Japanese population could limit generalizability to other ethnicities. Patients could also be excluded based on physician discretion due to certain stent and lesion characteristics. However, the paper really did not elaborate on this at all. It appeared that very few patients were excluded for this, but nonetheless should definitely be considered a limitation since it was kind of vague and we really don't know what these specific characteristics were. Another thing is that there was a significant reduction seen in non-cardiovascular death, even though fatal bleeding seemed to be the same in both groups. So it's kind of unclear why there would be this difference in non-cardiovascular death based on just the pathophysiology and the mechanism of these drugs.
So let's return to our case. My first question is, should clopidogrel be discontinued in this case, regardless of the anticoagulation that you might end up selecting, whether that's warfarin or DOAC? And are there specific patients who really should be taking anticoagulants with an antiplatelet therapy to prevent vascular events?
Yeah, so let's take the first part of the question. So in my opinion, I would probably stop his antiplatelet therapy at this point, which he's on clopidogrel, given that this patient will be started on oral anticoagulation therapy for his atrial fibrillation. I think that it would definitely be reasonable based on the FIRE trial because he appears to fit the FIRE population pretty well. So his PCI was about a year ago. He has atrial fibrillation. His blood pressure is controlled. Another thing I'm thinking about is that he is older at an age of 71, which increases his risk of bleeding. And of course, cost. So cost is maybe not clinically the most pertinent variable here, but practically, if the patient can't afford his med, it's definitely another reason to get rid of medications that may perhaps be unnecessary. I think it's definitely important to recognize that this trial was conducted with only rivaroxaban as the anticoagulant. I think most people would probably be comfortable applying these results to other 10A inhibitors, such as apixaban. I think when it comes to dabigatran and warfarin, it may be a little bit more unclear whether or not we can generalize these results to those other agents, especially because there was actually a trial called the OAC alone trial that was similar to a FIRE, but the patients were predominantly on warfarin as the anticoagulant of choice. And this trial was actually stopped early due to poor enrollment, and no really good conclusions could be drawn as a result of that. And also in general, in our AFib trials, the data does suggest that there are higher rates of MI with warfarin as compared to the DOACs. And then as far as dabigatran, the reason we might worry applying this for patients on dabigatran would be that there has been a signal for an increase in MI in some of the landmark atrial fibrillation trials with dabigatran. Large registry data suggests that perhaps there's no difference across the DOACs in terms of risk of MI, but I think the point really is here that it's unclear, and if given the option, we would be a lot more comfortable using 10A inhibitors and a little bit more unsure with warfarin and dabigatran.
If I could just reiterate a couple of things. So first and foremost, it's really important to recognize that anyone with acute coronary syndrome or is within a year of PCI or CABG absolutely does not fit this trial. And so they really shouldn't be included in this discussion at all. They obviously and very clearly have an indication to be on both an antiplatelet and an anticoagulant. Certainly, though, there are patients that should continue on both an antiplatelet and an anticoagulant, even though they're more than a year out from their acute events. And so some examples of this might include younger patients who are at risk for recurrent events. And that simply stems from the fact that they're at a lower risk for bleed and they have potentially more to benefit from being on both therapies. Other considerations are patients with peripheral vascular disease, patients with a history of recurrent events that don't really fit the mold of this trial very well. And so those are some scenarios where we might actually consider extending the antiplatelet therapy in combination with the anticoagulant.
Well, Zach, Alina, thank you for joining me today to discuss the use of antiplatelet therapy in patients who have a strong indication for anticoagulation therapy. And we've learned a lot about the potential risks of dual antithrombotic therapy over the past decade. And it's clear the use of the two agents together, anticoagulant and antiplatelet therapy, increases the risk of bleeding. And there are many patients who can just use an anticoagulant and would provide protection against another vascular event, whether it's arterial or stroke. Obviously, those that are closest to their acute coronary syndrome or stent placement, they may need to be on dual therapy for a period of time. Well, tell us what you think. Based on these data, are you actively taking patients off of aspirin who are taking a DOAC? And are there specific patient populations you believe really should continue aspirin therapy despite concurrent anticoagulant use? Well, remember, only iFormRx members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. If you're not already a member of iFormRx, please do sign up today. It's free. And be sure to tell your colleagues, residents, and students to join iFormRx as well. I also want to make you aware that we've partnered with the American Pharmacists Association to offer this program for board recertification credit to board-certified ambulatory care pharmacists. So if you would like to earn credit for this program, click on the link posted below the commentary on our website. And lastly, a big thank you to all the volunteers who help make iFormRx possible. Special thanks to Emily Prohaska, who works at LMH Health in Lawrence, Kansas. And not only did Emily accept my invitation to become a member of the iFormRx Advisory Board some years ago, but she volunteered to author several commentaries, recruited new authors, provided exceptional feedback in her peer reviews, and persuaded her residents and students to become members of iFormRx too. So thank you, Emily, for being such an evangelist for iFormRx. And until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx, signing off.